Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. I'm Fred Stoltzfus, sitting in for David Inge, and during this hour, we're going to be talking with Robert Capello. He's a conductor, composer, and commentator who's had a very versatile career bringing audiences to classical music. He's a composer as well, and his setting of a composition called Dr. Seuss, Green Eggs and Ham, has been called the most successful piece written for families in this half century. He's also the conductor and creative director for family music for the Fleet Boston's Celebrity Series and has been conductor director of family music for the New York 92nd Street Y and numerous other conducting engagements. He was conductor of the Yale Symphony Orchestra for 6 years. He's a graduate of that institution, and he also went to the Eastman School of Music. He also studied with Nadia Boulanger, and he won the first prize in the Fontainebleau Casadesus piano competition, was second place winner in the Antal Doradi Conductors Competition with the Detroit Symphony. During the course of this program, of course, he's going to have lots to say about how to listen to classical music, and we invite you to call us as well if you have questions you'd like to direct to him. The phone number in Champaign County is 333-9455, and we have a toll-free line as well, good for anywhere else you are listening to us this morning, and that number is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to join our conversation, please call us sooner rather than later in the program. So we'll start off with our discussion with Robert, and perhaps you could begin by telling us, what is it about what's so great about music?
Well, you know, it's funny. This thing actually began with a truly humiliating experience. I was very fortunate or unfortunate, depending on whether you're talking to me or my mother, to have dropped out of college to go study with the legendary Nadia Boulanger. For those of you who do not know that name, maybe you've seen the movie Love Story. And in the movie Love Story, Ally McGraw was supposed to have a scholarship to study with the great Nadia Boulanger, but instead she decided to stay home, marry Ryan O'Neill, and die of leukemia. So I decided, rather than taking that course, I would go try to study with Nadia Boulanger. And I still remember this incredible first lesson that I had, which is really the beginning of what makes it great. I went to this famous apartment, and talk about intimidating. Her apartment is on Place Boulanger. They had actually named the street after her. So I walk up to this legendary apartment where Stravinsky had studied, Gershwin, Bernstein, all these Copland had spent years. And I go for my first lesson. I'm preparing for this competition, and I had a Mozart sonata that I had to play for her. So I sat down in this legendary apartment, absolutely terrified, and I started to play the beginning of this Mozart sonata. Or I thought I started to play this Mozart sonata, but let me see if I can get some keyboards out. There we go. Here we go. And I started to play like this. And she hit me. And she hit me incredibly hard. And, you know, she was 85 years old at the time, and everyone said she was blind. But she hit me right in the shoulder, in that, you know, that place that really hurts in your shoulder. I never believed she was blind after that. And so she hits me in the shoulder, and she says, Capilov, this is grotesque. She says, you play this exquisite passage as if it were this. Okay, how many of you actually listening to this program heard the difference between those two versions? Well, I'm going to be truly honest with you. I did not hear the difference. Now, I like to tell myself that the reason I didn't hear the difference was because, well, you know, I'd just been slugged in the arm. I'd just been called Capilov and grotesque in the same sentence, neither of which I was used to, having done pretty well at Yale before this. But I, at the moment, didn't hear. She went on to explain. She said, Mozart would never write this. That last piece of business is redundant information. It insults the intelligence of the audience. Once I've done this, to repeat it is an insult. Mozart instead goes, and that's what makes Mozart great, that slight difference. Not only that, in the left hand, he would never play that same boring chord that I played for you with only three notes. This chord, he adds one note to that, this. Subtle difference. Here's the plain one. Here's Mozart's. That blur, that wonderful blur. So instead of this boring passage, he writes this, and then not this, but this, which is so beautiful. And that's what makes Mozart great. And that was really the beginning of what makes it great. When I realized that so much great music can just go by And unless you're paying unbelievable attention, you actually miss the fantastic rewards that it has. And from that moment on, I was determined to somehow make sure I would do everything in my power to give everybody else the fantastic experience that I had just had at the hands of this great teacher of, in 1 second, taking something that had seemed ordinary and watching it become extraordinary.
And how did you get from that experience to conducting itself or to composition or to the interaction with audiences that you now do regularly?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because I would love to tell you that I just walked out of that studio and immediately had a career and knew exactly what I was going to do. But the truth is, you know, there's a great quote by Heidegger where it says, "Life is meant to be lived forward but understood backwards." You know, when I look back on it, it looks like I took this logical path. But going forward, I had no idea. All I knew was that I wanted to do something about it. I was at first just a regular conductor. I went to Yale. I was very fortunate to get a job at Yale the day after I went out of graduate school as conductor of the symphony and a professor there. And so for 6 years, I got this great chance to lead my own orchestra. And then I had a pivotal event which happened, which was very odd. I was fortunate or unfortunate, depending on who you are, to get a chance to conduct a show on Broadway while I was at Yale. And it was a death-defying moment where I had to make my audition by just showing up on Friday night and conducting a sold-out Tony Award-winning musical with no rehearsal. But it went fine. And in any case, for a while, I took over the show. And for a while, I was traveling to New York on the train and conducting the show at night and then going back to Yale during the day and conducting Beethoven. And again, this was a second pivotal moment. I had really not done much with the Boulanger lesson except to have it sort of sit in my mind. But every night, I would conduct this show, and it was sold out. It was the Tony Award-winning musical, mm-hmm. and people were paying $60 a ticket to come. And they were, most importantly, getting it. I mean, they understood every note of that music, every gesture. They knew when to clap, when not to clap. They knew what was a ballad, what was moving. They really spoke the language of that music. And then I would go back and conduct Beethoven, and you could not help but notice that there was not the same kind of first-order response. People were much more polite, but they really didn't get it. It wasn't their language. And again, that was the second step. That was the thing that, again, put it in my head that I just felt it's unbearable to conduct this music and have people not get it. So once again, I didn't run from there to start doing What Makes It Great on Performance Today, but I knew that I just no longer wanted to do it if people didn't get it. So my first attempts were really just, I started to write lots of program essays, you know, really thoughtful essays that I hoped would get people into the music. I started to do pre-concert lectures like everybody else does, doing anything that I could to get people into the music. I would teach classes and things like that. I would do weekend-long immersion experiences on, say, the Beethoven concertos where I'd conduct them all but do some programs before. But then I came to NPR, and that was a pivotal change. I had done an unusual program in New York. Part of my desperate belief about people is that if you give them the right stuff, they'll be able to hear this in a second knowing nothing. You don't have to know anything. So I tried to make the opening of the Emperor Concerto as staggeringly bizarre as it sounded to me. So I put together an evening of all the worst concertos of the time that everybody knew that weren't Beethoven's. You know, because it was interesting. I couldn't find anyone who even knew the name of a concerto for piano written at the same time as Beethoven's. So I thought, I'm going to get people into that ear. So I found all these awful concertos that were written at the same time by Dussek and Clementi, and I put on about an hour and a half of what was in people's ear at the time, these concertos. And then we actually played the Beethoven, and it was a staggering experience. Performance Today recorded that performance and asked me to do a little commentary for it, which I did. And then they asked me would I like to do some kind of programming for them on a long-term basis. And that's when I started What Makes It Great, taking these little 15-minute segments and hoping that if I could help America listen to these little 15 seconds of music for 15 minutes each week, that it would start to change how people listen.
Wonderful. We're talking with Robert Capello, who's in town to give a talk at the Fillinger Great Hall tonight. It's at 7 p.m. He's going to be giving a lecture on What Makes It Great. And it's in reference to two concerts by the Alexander String Quartet, the first of which occurs on Thursday, October 25th at 7 p.m., and the second on Saturday, October 27th at 10 p.m. I'll give some more information about those concerts a bit later, but we have a caller on line four, and we'll open up to him. Welcome. You're on Focus 580. Okay. That didn't work out.
Well, you know, I like that because that was a provocative silence. You know, and that provocative silence is so at the heart of Beethoven. You know that moment where we're all sitting waiting to hear the call and we hear nothing? That's the kind of listening that I'm really trying to get people to have for this evening. You know, so much of Beethoven is filled with those pregnant pauses, those silences, but they only work when you play along.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the repertoire that you're going to be speaking of, the string quartet. And I have a couple of questions to start with. We had here last week, I don't know, you may have heard about this, a concert by the Emerson String Quartet as part of a production called The Noise of Time. And it wasn't a typical string quartet, but it was a marvelous experience. I expect what we're going to be hearing from the Alexander is a more typical string quartet comes on stage, the lights go down, and we listen to them and watch them play. What should we look for? What should we listen to there?
Well, the first thing is, that's exactly the point of tonight. Let me explain what tonight is going to be about. What we're going to do is we're going to have the quartet on stage with one piece. Because, you know, one of the things that I found is it's very hard to listen often to a whole concert of music, especially if this is not something you normally do. 2 hours is a lot of music to listen to. So when I do these What Makes It Great evenings, I just pick one piece. There's really only 30 minutes of music on the program. And what I try to do is pick selected passages and use them as kind of like windows of understanding, of ways of listening. So what we're going to do tonight is hopefully going to prepare people to listen to that concert. Like, for example, I might take apart the very opening. The opening of this quartet is absolutely staggering. And it's staggering not only for what it is, but for what it isn't. It starts off with three little pieces of music, but they're surrounded as like islands with silence around them. And the silence is so extraordinary. It starts like this. And that pause is so fantastic. But to really make sure people learn to hear those pauses, what I will have the quartet do is actually take out the pause. Beethoven didn't write this, but I'll have the quartet go on like this and go right on. And I'll play that a few times with no pause. Then we'll play the pause. One, two. And suddenly, hopefully, that pause will really come alive. So that's what this evening is about, is taking apart little moments like that and showing you, if you're really on the edge of your seat listening, what is spectacular about this music. Because, you know, one of the things that's so fascinating about Beethoven to me is that in its time, this music was incredibly radical, cutting edge, avant-garde, on the edge of your seat, leaving people screaming in the aisles. And now it's become the most mainstream acceptable concert fare. So my goal is to get people to scream in the aisles and leave.
Well, we'll look forward to that experience. And we'll try once again to take this call on line 4 from Taylorville. Go ahead. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would like to submit that programs such as the one you represent that afternoon thing, they do give us some great music, but it's basically music's greatest hits. For example, you haven't even begun to do justice to the avant-garde of the 20th century, people like Berez, Elliot Carter, less well-known things of Ives, numerous Berio, Nono. I could go on and on. There are dozens of great 20th century composers whose music you don't represent, and you'll combat the masses. The lowest common denominator, I think it has something to do with your funding system, so you have to pander to people that I think it would be a disgrace to call them music likers with works like that damn Symphony of Sorrowful Songs, which is surely one of the most abjectly smarmy, tasteless, cloying pieces of mere pigeon pop from hell that I think any civilized human being has ever heard. You don't do justice to the earlier music. For example, composers like Michel.
Excuse me, are you a musician yourself? Are you a musician yourself?
I have played piano. Right now I've got a rather messed up one in my house. I haven't worked on. I had trouble with the risers. Years ago, and I took the action out.
Well, let me take on your question head on. First, several things. First of all, I, as a musician myself, feel that we should only be so lucky that looking at the music of the Beethoven would be condemning and lowering ourselves to the masses. As far as I'm concerned, there has never been any greater music than the music of Mozart, Beethoven, and Bach. And I never feel the slightest need to apologize for looking at some of the most spectacular music ever written in the history of mankind. So my first answer to your question is I never feel that looking at Beethoven is dumbing down. I should be so lucky as to look up to the music of Beethoven for my life. The 16 quartets stagger me every time I look at them. So my first answer is I do not feel that any of the great music we look at is by any means dumbing down. It's some of the best things ever been produced in the history of civilization. Second question, in terms of the breadth of the repertoire, I agree with you to some extent. And in fact, I was in Washington taping shows last week on Steve Reich and Ives and Webern. So I would say that it is not neglected as completely as you say. But yes, to some extent, it is outside the realm of most listeners, and it's hard music. And I have to tell you, what I feel, for me at least, is my only rule for doing a What Makes It Great is it has to be a piece of music that I think is great. And for me, that's as likely to be the music of Charles Ives or Steve Reich or John Adams as it is actually a whole program I did on Ave Maria, the chant with Lionheart. So I'm open to the whole realm of recorded music and history, and I never feel like one should apologize for the great masters. But thank you for your thought.
I would submit that there are other composers who are manifestly great, like Berg and Bartok, and I'm trying to scratch my head remembering the last time I heard a Bartok quartet, for example, or let's say something like the Bagatelle, any of his work for solo piano.
Well, I think it was 6 weeks ago when I did Bartok 3 on NPR, but I totally agree with your point, and thank you for your thought.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much for calling. Let's work on another question here. When one hears a string quartet performance, what kinds of cues can you get from watching the people play about their attitudes of performance?
You know, that's a fantastic question, and I'm going to answer that in several ways. One of the things that's wonderful, and I thought about this last night since I went to the Leipzig Gewandhaus concert, and there was actually someone from the football team at the concert for the first time, and I had had a talk with him about the teamwork aspect. You know, did this actually show up for him as he watched this kind of ensemble playing? One of the things that's so remarkable about a string quartet is it's a leaderless ensemble, and in a way, it's the perfect democracy. It's literally a physical expression of democracy in action, because no one person is leading, but all of them are doing it together. You know, on an early stage, for example, if you see a beginning string quartet, at a given moment in time, if you watch closely, you'll physically see some person take the lead. For example, at some moment, the first violinist will raise his head, and that will cue the other players. If the violist has the important line, he will raise his head or lean into the other players. At an elementary level, it almost is written out in their parts, I'm going to lead this. But when you see the true masters, like the Emerson Quartet, who was here last time, in a way, they're all doing it. Even though one person is taking the lead, somehow they're all breathing together. And that sense that over time you've become such an ensemble, kind of like the Chicago Bulls in the Michael Jordan heyday, that you're such an ensemble that literally you're all thinking as an organism, is physically reflected by the way they all move towards each other. And there's a kind of visual ballet at a string quartet concert that you can never hear on a CD that makes that live experience so fascinating. It's the essence of teamwork, the essence of democracy. Everyone has a voice. Sometimes one's in the lead, sometimes another's in a lead. But fundamentally, it's the whole body politic together making something that neither of them could do alone. You know, oftentimes I've done, solo performances with individual players from quartets, and there's nothing like the magic that happens when all four of them get together. They truly produce something that none of them could have produced on their own.
Right. Let's talk about that a little bit further. Sometimes when people talk about Beethoven, they get very involved with certain biographical aspects of his life, and there's no question there's compelling stories to be told at every point in his interesting career. But that question, as interesting as it may be to probe later on, I'm interested in the narrative aspects of a string quartet. I mean, can one look at a string quartet or any particular one of these as telling a kind of story? Or is that a useful way to get into the greatness of the music in any way?
Well, let me answer that in three different ways. Actually, let me answer it first by a fun story. You know, very often when I do these What Makes It Great programs, and particularly when I go to places I haven't been before, like this, I go on AM radio, and very often I offer free tickets to the person who hates classical music the most. And I ask people to call in with why they hate classical music or why they even hate people who like classical music. And one of the interesting times was I was in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I was on a show called Coffee Talk. And let me tell you, they did not want me on this show. This was a show that never did classical music, and she was not interested in having me. And it was actually run by Barbara Coffee. I mean, what can I say? And I got to the studios and she said, well, you know, I'm not really very happy to have you here. And I said, well, I guess I'm not that happy to be here. And I said, why not? And she said, well, you know, this is a show about classical music. No one is interested in it. No one will call in. You know, there's just absolutely no interest. And I said, well, I'll do my best. So I offered on the air, you know, free tickets to the person who hated it the most. And Anne called in and I asked her why she hated it. And she said, I hate it because it's long and it's boring and it has no plot. Which I thought was a fantastic observation because, as you were just saying, notes go by, but is there a plot? You know, if there's nothing to hang on to, you know, at least if there are words, like in an opera, there's a literal physical plot. But if it's just notes going by, there's really no plot to it. So I said, I want you to come to the concert, stand up and tell us why you hate it. She did, and she got huge applause. You know, she opened that possibility for everyone else. And I said, well, this evening is dedicated to you, Beethoven detective novels, sitcoms, and sonatas. And it was about what is the plot? Because though the notes are not saying any words, there's a tremendous musical plot going on if you actually hear it. For example, in the piece we're going to listen to tonight, it starts off with those two whacks, those two hammer stroke chords like this. And then there's a silence. Then something else happens, which if you're not listening closely, just sounds like it's new. And it sounds completely new, but in fact, a plot is already developing. If here's the whack notes, the next thing is actually those notes with two in between. And it's already developing a plot. So here's the first and fourth notes. If I put two notes in between, I get... And it becomes the next idea. And then we're going to see this, and in fact, that will be the whole story for tonight. Like a detective novel, we are going to explore all the things that happens to just those two ideas. Because just like in any great John Grisham novel, you have something that's set up, it gets developed, and you're sitting there on the edge of your seat wondering, how is it going to turn out? How is it going to turn out? The whole idea of what makes it great is to put people in the presence of older music where those ideas might not be as obvious, where they might not be guessing, so that they can truly sit on the edge of their seat and guess along with Beethoven what's going to happen with those. Will they ever be related? Are they separate? Do they relate? How do they come together? What can I do with it? So there's an enormous plot going on to these pieces of music, but it's not an obvious one.
Right. And of course, one of the very late string quartets has the question and then the answer from Beethoven himself. Muss es sein, right. And es muss sein.
Right, and must it be or it must be. But the interesting thing about that one is it actually turns out that that was a joke. Must it be, it must be from a drinking song that he actually, well, anyway, that's a long story. And, you know, I think it gets to the other question or that I think you had a sub question in, like the whole biography right. issue, you know, is it helpful to probe that? You know, it's interesting, certain composers make you feel compelled to biography. Mm-hmm. You know, if you listen to a piece of music by Mozart or Haydn, you don't feel inevitably like I have to run out to People magazine to find out what was his life like. Though the music is exquisite, it doesn't really compel you. But when you listen to this kind of aggressive assertiveness of Beethoven, you feel like you want to know what was the story. It kind of has such a personal component that you feel compelled to ask, what's the biography behind somebody who could grab us by the throat and begin a piece, whack, whack? And so I think actually, you know, that's a turning point. It's interesting. Beethoven once, you know, said that there'll maybe 1,000 princes, but there will only be one Beethoven. Yeah. And in a way, that's a turning point in music history, because instead of being a kind of court employee or servant to the rich, providing nice, dainty entertainment, suddenly the tables have shifted. I am the center of the universe. My personality is the center of the universe. And you are there to hear me speak my thoughts. I come first. And I think that's part of why we feel such a compulsion to understand his actual personality.
Of course, Beethoven said some of those very same things in reference to other works. When he wrote his Mass in C and gave the first performance in Eisenstadt, the composer Hummel, who was active there, came up to Beethoven after having heard of all of Haydn's Masses before that, saying, "My dear Beethoven, what have you gone and done now?"
Right.
And of course, he was put off by that and never wanted to speak to him again.
Yes. One of the other things I love about Beethoven is he did not suffer commentary kindly. Anyone who ever said anything or even hinted at a bad attitude towards him, he rejected forever. But you know, that's in the music. That kind of violence, that kind of abruptness, yet also the incredible humanity. Everyone who ever talked about Beethoven's personality talked about both sides of it. You know, his willingness at the merest slight to run from an aristocratic salon, to resent even having to play for his dinner, so to speak. But yet the incredible warmth and generosity and the repentance he felt towards his friends after he had treated them unbelievably horribly. And yet it's all in the music. And I think, you know, it's that kind of humanity. We often tend to think of these people as Olympian gods with perfection as human beings. Yet, in fact, it's their flaws and imperfections that are so ingrained in the music, which make it resonate still, I think, for us today.
Right. We're talking with Robert Capello here at Focus 580, and he's going to be giving a lecture tonight at 7 p.m. in the Fellinger Great Hall. It's free, and he's going to be talking about what makes it great in reference to Beethoven's String Quartet, Opus 59, Number 2. If you have questions or something you'd like him to talk about, feel free to give us a call at 333-9455 in Champaign or 800-222-9455 if you're calling outside of this local area.
It'd be fun to hear what people think about classical music. Anyone who wants to have a go at it, like it, hate it, just what are your thoughts about it? It's fun to hear.
You've been involved in lots of different projects in addition to talks about string quartets. Talk a little bit about the programs that you've done for children. I'm particularly interested in Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Hams.
Well, you know, my whole goal has always been to make something that I thought was fantastic available to as many people as I possibly could. You know, E.M. Forrester has that great line, connect, only connect. I just always wanted this music to connect. And so What Makes It Great was something I started with for adults. But then I thought, what about this whole generation of kids who's really having so little experience with music? And again, I started to think, what could I do that would get millions of families to get involved in the world of music who otherwise might not get involved? And I thought, you know, what if I could get Green Eggs and Ham? The Seuss Estate had never allowed a Seuss book to be set to music, but I thought if I could get that and write some piece to it, it would be the one opera libretto that all of America would know by heart before they actually walked into the room. Mm-hmm. So I started my six-month siege of the Seuss Estate to get permission. And actually, the key to getting permission was when I realized that Green Eggs and Ham is not just a child's book about trying to get an adult to eat green eggs and ham, but it's actually a parable about prejudice. That Green Eggs and Ham represents all those things we're sure we won't like till we try them, which is classical music, which is what I told the Seuss Estate, who was so unwilling to let anyone try one of their books. So I said, I mean, here's this great book about prejudice. Try it, and you may. Mm-hmm. So finally, they did agree to let me try it, to write the piece on spec, and then they agreed to let me write one, you know, to do one performance of it, and then it was a terrific success, you know, one of those lucky reviews. And after that, they were fantastic. And now it's performed 300, 400 times a year, and millions of Americans are willing to try a concert because they see that it's a piece of Dr. Seuss. And it was just a fantastic way to introduce people to opera, singing, and classical music via the world of Dr. Seuss.
That's wonderful. We have a caller from Terre Haute. Good morning. You're on Focus 580 with Robert Capello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I just wanted to share with you that about 3 years ago, we went to Jacksonville, Oregon, where the Brit performs, and saw a program that was probably meant to be for children, but it certainly was not just for children. And it was titled Beethoven Lives Upstairs.
Uh-huh.
And it was one of the most charming and delightful performances I have ever seen. It was the story of a young man whose father had died, and the mother had rented an upstairs room to this man.
Mm-hmm.
And he has this correspondence with his uncle, who lives in another city. And he, of course, is explaining that this man is disruptive because he plays the piano so loudly and all
the story of my life.
And then it brings the uncle's point of view in, that how fortunate this child is to have this man living in his home and the enrichment that he has brought to the family and, you know, to the world, really.
You know, I think
it's
one of the,
really beautifully done.
And I think one of the wonderful things about that is it also humanizes these Olympian figures, you know, these people who we think of as somehow gods that were not human. And it somehow makes that a human reality, which is what's so wonderful about that program. It turns Beethoven from this, you know, god composer into a human being, and particularly in relationship to a child.
Yes, and the relationship of the child and the uncle is such an important part because mm-hmm. of the generation.
Yes. It's very moving, the cross-generational thing. And by the way, you know, another point that you just said, which I really agree with, is that all the best children's things are really for adults as well.
Sure.
You know, Green Eggs and Ham is on one hand for kids, but it's also one of the great things about all the Dr. Seuss books is that they're so sophisticated. You know the book, Oh, the Places You'll Go. I mean, that's given to as many college graduating seniors as it is to kids. So I think all the best children's stuff operates on many levels. And by the way, that was something I felt as a challenge, was to write music that would be as fun for people like you in the audience, the parents taking the kids, as it would be for the kids. Because, you know, there are so few experiences in our culture where the kids and the parents get to both simultaneously enjoy something that's interesting for both. That it's not you're chaperoning them and just taking your kid, but that it actually offers on multiple levels food for thought for all of them. So I agree with you. I think Beethoven Lives Upstairs is a perfect example. And that's something I strive for in every kid's piece of music I ever write, that the parents should have as good a time as the kids do.
Well, let me put a plug in for our composer, director, gentleman who is our man here at the Terre Haute Symphony, and that's David Bowden. He includes children in their programming for Christmas, the choir, and also musicians. They have one concert which is open to the public, which is in the park, mm-hmm. one of the parks here, and he is one also who spoke out about not diminishing the arts programs and particularly the music programs for the children in the schools.
Great.
I think he's very courageous, and he's one who also does give a pre-concert program, which whether or not we need it, he is willing to do that, and I admire him greatly for that. He's really quite a nice gentleman, I think.
Great. Thanks so much for calling.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Bye. Robert, let's talk a little bit about the business of performing inside of an ensemble. We were talking off air about one of your early experiences playing for Leopold Stokowski. And the reason I'm asking you about it is because many people who perhaps don't perform in an ensemble or don't perform at all see doing something like that, playing with a great conductor in a great orchestra, as being just a terribly scary and frightening experience. And it might be useful to hear your experience with him and how that transfers to the overall experience of hearing and being in a musical setting.
Well, I think playing in an ensemble is about the most thrilling thing that could be legal on the planet. You know, my entire career as a composer and conductor really grew out of my experience playing in orchestras, which I still to this day think is the most staggeringly exhilarating thing you could possibly do. You know, I was very fortunate. I'll do the Stokowski one in a minute, but I was really a pivotal moment for me was when I was a freshman. I was a violinist in the Yale Symphony. And, you know, at that time, though I had played a lot of piano music, I really didn't know that much sophisticated orchestral literature. And I still remember to this day, the very first Yale Symphony Orchestra rehearsal was Petrushka. And I was playing violin. And we got to this Russian dance in Petrushka. And all I played, my own part was just chunk, 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 chunk. And the brass were playing this fantastic. I literally could hardly sit still. It was the most exhilarating experience because, again, you become part of a whole in a way that you could never do by yourself. Playing piano by yourself is thrilling, but when literally you are part of this enormous sound going around, and not only that, it's one of the most intricately organized clockworks you could imagine. It just is so uplifting, you can't imagine anything better. So I would say that for me, playing in an ensemble, and I guess it's similar to someone playing on a fantastic sports team, just that sense that you are part of this organism that is functioning at such a high level, it's still the most exhilarating thing. And at Yale, I got to play all these pieces. Mahler, I mean, I still remember playing Mahler's Second Symphony for the first time, and when the soprano would come out of the chorus, it wasn't my part, but you were somehow part of the most unbelievable experience of your life. It really should not have been legal, you know. So I think that was very formative. The experience of playing for someone like Stokowski when I was, you know, like 11 years old and he was about 120 was a different kind of experience, because the interesting thing was he was very old at that time and quite infirm, and it took him nearly, you know, 20 minutes to walk to the podium. And, you know, we were 11 or 12 years old and we were all thinking, oh my God, this is going to be a horrible experience. And amazingly, the second he got to the podium, and we were playing his own music, his own arrangement of Bach, The minute he got on the podium, he was a terror. I mean, it was as if he were 20 years old. He was correcting this, yelling at this, and other people were terrified. But I was just thrilled because it made you realize that somehow the spirit that's in that music is beyond any age, and it transforms the person who's performing it or working with it as if it doesn't matter. You could be 95, 25, but the spirit somehow lives through. So I found it just thrilling that this person who could hardly walk, could barely talk, when kind of aided by the music within him, literally became 25 years old again. And it was one of the great experiences of my life.
Wonderful. We have a caller on line one from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Earlier on, you asked for people to call in who weren't crazy about classical music.
So great.
I'm responding to that. But I'm not crazy about it. I do own a CD of The Planets by Holst, and I play it loudly when I want to get invigorated.
Yeah, Jupiter's great. The first one is great.
One,
absolutely. That's the one you like, right? I know.
Fantastic
rhythm. I love that.
Yes, but my story, a friend of mine in town had a friend who was in a quartet, a string quartet that's going to be in St. Louis, and he talked me into going. I just went for the road trip because I thought that'd be fun. But when I got there, we stopped at the violists.
Well done.
Hotel room, and he had a new viola that he wanted to try out, and so he played it for us. And then, I mean, that was beautiful. He wasn't sure if he liked it, blah, blah, blah. Then we went and heard the quartet, and there is something about being there. It lifted me off my feet, sort of, to hear. It was in a church. And
Neat.
It really was moving. I still haven't bought any recorded. When I hear it on the radio, it doesn't do that much for me. But having been there was quite different.
Well, you know, the live experience is really such a completely different thing. As fantastic as it is that we have CDs, so you have all this music available, there's a kind of cold chilliness that sort of, you lose that personal connection. It's interesting, the part of your story that you like best was when he was just trying it out for you.
Yes.
Because you felt it was an intimate, personal, one-on-one experience. And fundamentally, that's what music is about. It's about connecting. That kind of intermediate experience in which it's just a person hearing a recorded sound alone, solipsistically in their room. You know, another thing that's great about a concert is it's like performing. When there's 1,000 people listening, it's different than one person listening.
Yeah.
You know, the silence of the second bar of this piece that I'm going to make you feel tonight cannot be produced with you alone in a room nearly as powerfully as when 1,000 people are hanging there together. In fact, I'm going to do a little exercise on that. You know, getting everybody to hear it together to show you how differently electrified the room becomes when 1,000 people are listening. You know, that's one of the reasons why I think after September 11th, so many people wanted to come to concerts.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of commonality and a community participation in listening that binds people together. And music live has absolutely nothing to do with music on CDs. So don't feel bad that you haven't bought any. Just come to the concert.
I'm coming tonight.
All right. See you there.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for your call. We have another caller on line two from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. You asked for controversy.
Sure.
I'm bringing it to you in the form of jazz.
Okay.
I was a classical music person originally, 7 years of piano lessons.
Uh-huh.
And my son is a performing arts major in jazz bass.
Uh-huh.
So I want to know what you think about that.
Oh, I think it's fantastic. You know, one of the things I do in What Makes It Great is I've done every kind of music. One of my most fun What Makes It Greats ever was I had a jazz band in Boston, and I did a whole evening on Duke Ellington's Such Sweet Thunder. And in fact, I did that in several places. And taking apart Duke Ellington is fantastic. In fact, I grew up with Downbeat as my favorite magazine, and I spend as many hours, you know, playing music at the keyboard. I grew up playing as much jazz as anything else. I think some of that music is so fantastic. And what makes it great, you know, I often do classical music, but to me, what makes it great is the same in anything. You can look at a Gregorian chant. You can look at a bass line from Charlie Mingus. You could look at gospel music. Great is great. And I absolutely, one of the great things or influences in my life has been Leonard Bernstein. And one of the things that made him so special was he didn't get that there was a division between music. It was just great. He could write West Side Story. He could play jazz. He could write Prelude, Fugue, and Riffs. And then he could go do Beethoven and Mahler. And they were all one world. These kind of artificial divisions that we put between music are really for commerce, not for art. And great art is great art. And I have spent as much fantastic time with jazz as I have with anything else. And I will tell you that half of the music I write has tons of jazz in it, even Green Eggs and Ham actually takes I've Been Working on the Railroad and turns it into jazz. So it's fantastic music, and I think you should feel proud of your son.
Well, I am proud of my son. Thank you. I'm happy to talk to you.
It's the best.
Tell him you think it's great.
I think it's great.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
We have another caller on line one from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I have a question. I don't consider myself an emotional person, but there are certain music that when I hear it, it makes my skin tingle. One is the Mozart clarinet quintet, the second movement, and anything Puccini. What is it about this music that does this to me?
Well,
what is the physical... what happens in you physically that makes you do this?
Well, you know, first of all, that is a fantastic question that thousands of scientists, musicians, and people have tried to answer for 1,000 years. So, though, I first have to say, we can't answer you. I'll give you a shot. First of all, I wouldn't say you're not an emotional person. If you respond to Puccini and the slow movement of the Mozart clarinet quintet with tingles, you are an emotional person.
Okay.
But one of the things that I think it does is it bypasses, music bypasses the normal stuff, the stuff that's in our everyday life. It somehow goes right to the core, and it hits at the emotions without anything intervening. You know, I think the thing is, in Puccini, the normal emotions that we all feel but sometimes repress are right out there, exponentially increased. You know, the truth is, if we had not all felt about someone the same way that Puccini's lovers have in Bohème, we wouldn't respond to it. But in fact, what he does is he allows us to see those emotions, experience fully by somebody else, and participate them in a kind of safe way that it might be scary to do if they were ourselves. But if we did not feel that, if we did not all want to love someone as much as Rodolfo loved Mimi, if we did not all feel as bereft over some kind of goodbye as all the addios in Puccini, we would never be so moved and go to those concerts. But he's someone who allows himself to experience that for us, put it out there for us, and then we get to experience it via that. In a way, it all starts back at Beethoven. You know, before Beethoven, so much of music, even though it was moving, was about a kind of entertainment. It could be moving and sophisticated, but it was a kind of servant mentality. With Beethoven, it says, my emotions are the center. I am going to experience inwardly what I experience, and then I'm going to offer it to you. And that's why you come to a concert, to have the experience of experiencing what I experience inwardly. So I think Puccini shows you what you actually feel, though might be afraid of.
What is it musically that he's doing that makes it emotional?
Well, you know what I'm going to do? If you leave your name with our producer, I'm going to send you my taking apart of Madame Butterfly's aria and my taking apart of Nessun Dorma, two of my favorite Puccini arias that I took apart on What Makes It Great. And I'm going to send you a tape, and I'll show you measure by measure why it happens.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Let me just tell all of you who are listening, if you want to make your own skin tingle, come to the lecture tonight at 7 p.m. in the Fillinger Great Hall and see how Beethoven does it with Robert Capello's assistance with Opus 59, number 2. Let me also say that your skin will probably tingle if you come to the concerts, which are Thursday night at 7 p.m. in the Great Hall. The Alexander String Quartet will be playing three quartets, Opus 18, number 1, Opus 95, called Sirioso, and Opus 132. And then a second concert this week, Saturday, October 27th at 10 a.m. Note the time, 10 a.m. And again, three quartets, Opus 18, number 2, Opus 127, Opus 59, number 3. Let's talk briefly about another kind of experience of music, and that is from the perspective of the conductor. Maybe you want to just say a little bit about how that's different from playing violin in the Yale Orchestra or composing Dr. Susan Greeneggs.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I talked about those experiences playing in an orchestra, and that really is what led to conducting. One of the fantastic things when you're in an orchestra is you're playing one small part of something, but there's this unbelievable organism going on behind you. And from the minute I was taken by that, I wanted to lead it. I wanted to know all of it. You know, I sat in most orchestra rehearsals forgetting to come in because I was so busy listening to what everybody else was doing and trying to figure it out. And then I thought, you know, there's a shortcut here. I could actually look at the score and see it all. So I got so fascinated with that. And then I wanted to know it all. I wanted to be part of the big picture, and I wanted to see how it all fit together. You know, curiosity is the key to everything. And I think that's what really led to conducting. And then again, the thrill of playing in it is as fantastic as it is, not nearly as great as being in front of it. Because in a way, it's not like you're leading it, but you're somehow enabling it to happen. And that feeling that somehow you're allowing all these people to come together and the music is happening is truly a spectacular feeling.
We have another caller on line four from a mobile phone. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. Whenever I play classical music or offer a choice of music to people, the invariable comment is either no rap or no opera. Why is opera so hit on?
That's a great question.
Why is it just that people don't understand, you know, are left out of the plot again?
No, well, I think there are several reasons, and I'd love to do what makes it great out here on opera, but I think there are several barriers to opera. First is, and I've seen this from my own children, the actual sound of the voice is a kind of unusual sound production. It's in a very often high range, an extreme range. It's not a normal sounding voice. You know, in the same way, if you go to a kabuki theater, there's a kind of stylization that's not sort of part of our normal culture. So I think the first thing is the pure kind of sound of the voice is different. It's not in normal speaking range. One of the things that's wonderful is it's human emotions writ large. So therefore, things are higher than normal. And it's, for example, when someone sings a high C, it is all the emotion we normally feel in life, but multiplied. And the highness of the note isn't just a high note, but it's all that emotion that you couldn't say lower. So I think it's happening outside the normal range of speech. For example, if you compare the range of a Broadway song, which is often much closer to the human voice's natural speaking range, opera is often at an extreme range. I think the first barrier is just the sound of the voice. The second is that much of it is actually in foreign languages. Though these new surtitles have really let people in. It's very strange to just listen to something that you don't actually understand the words to. And I think that's part of it. The third is that I think, like many things, it is on one level artificial, yet the artificiality actually gets at something realer. We've grown up since the era of photography in an era that's focused on realism. Movies and film and pictures have led us to be able to really depict reality as it is. And as we become more and more able to depict reality accurately, you know, if you look at the movie of Titanic, every fish fork is exactly correct. But as we are able to portray reality more and more accurately, we lose our ability to experience imaginative versions of reality that are not just accurate depictions, but are somehow abstractions. And I think that's why theater, in a way, is harder than movies, because there's a kind of abstraction to the movement. For example, in The Noise of Time that happened here last week, there was a wonderful, beautiful theatrical moment where Yuri Gagarin was pictured by just his feet and four dancers holding a helmet and his feet. It's an abstraction. It's not a reality. And I think opera operates on that level. Sometimes what it is the real emotion is dealt with in a kind of abstract way. But we all have felt, if we can get past the surface of that, the kinds of emotions that is about. And it's about the most core human emotions ever, but writ larger than we're normally used to experiencing them. So the highness of the voice and the writ largeness of the actual emotional interplay, I think, makes it difficult, but also makes it a fantastic opportunity.
So what would you suggest, shall we say, as an introduction opera to the non-opera lovers?
What makes it great with Rob on any great opera aria? And there are, you know, if you call NPR in Washington, I've taken apart for just that reason, because I wanted there to be some intermediary step before you actually had to go to the opera. And so I've taken apart nearly all of the major famous opera arias and just taken one of them at a time. So I would suggest calling NPR in Washington and ask them for all my opera, What Makes It Great. And I think that's a great introduction.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks very much for calling. Well, we're getting close to the end of our interview with Robert Kaplow, and I want to remind you of his lecture tonight at 7 p.m. in the Fellinger Great Hall. He's going to be talking about the Alexander String Quartet's upcoming performance of, among other pieces, Beethoven's Opus 59, Number 2. I'm going to ask him just to say a few words in conclusion about, you know, if you want to get into music more, this is how you would do it.
Yeah, well, one thing I want to say is that very often people think that they have to know a lot. You know, they have to have a lot of terminology. They have to know how to speak French, order fine wines, that there are all these barriers, opus numbers and things like that you have to really know a lot. You don't have to know anything. What you have to do is bring a tremendous willingness to listen. You know, we live in a culture which has tremendous amount of information coming at us every second of the day. And therefore, our attention spans are often short. We're used to seeing something happen quickly. What's great about great music is that it both demands and rewards. rewards great listening. And so in the end, all you have to do is bring your ears, your willingness, and listen.
That's wonderful. Let me remind you once again, there's a talk tonight at 7 p.m. in the Great Hall by Robert Capello. It's free. And then two concerts this week, Thursday, October 25 at 7 p.m., Saturday, October 27 at 10 a.m., six string quartets over two concert performances. If you're interested in ticket information, you can call the Kraner Center at 217-333-6280 or 800-KCPATIX. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, Robert, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the lecture this evening and hopefully seeing a lot of you who have been listening at the concert.
Come by and say hi if you come.
Thanks a lot. So that's it for Focus 580 this morning. Let me thank you once again, Robert, for being our guest, and thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for the news and the market update.